discuss the quantization of the free field, the scalar free field using functional integration. But now I will compute things. I have showed you yesterday that in principle, one should be able to do that by defining a functional integral, which is just generalization of the path integral to a quantum field, so an extended quantum system with relativistic invariance. But I've not showed you whether this formalism works or not. So remember, we started from the relativistic scalar field. So we have a field phi of x, where x belongs to Minkowski or Euclidean space. And it is defined at the classical level by the action S of phi, which is, and I will consider here the Euclidean action at some point. So I am in, let me assume that I am in d dimensions. And this is then d mu phi squared plus m squared over 2 phi squared. So this is the Euclidean action of the scalar field in d dimension. And in principle, everything amounts to compute a functional integral. So integral over some field configuration weighted by the factor, which is just the exponential of minus 1 over h bar times S of phi. Okay, and if you are able to compute this quantity and expectation value of observable using this functional integral, you should get, if the formalism works, quantity related to the quantum theory of the quantum field. Okay, so this is the Euclidean action. And I'm using the Euclidean action from start because simply the calculations are simpler and there are less problems with causality and connection with which boundary condition you use in time, etc. But we will go back after that to real Minkowski space. Yes? But they are just easier to deal with. Of course, there are also problems if you are considering this in a fixed setting with special boundary conditions. But it's just you start on safer ground and then you can reconstruct the theory in real space, in real time, by this trick of weak rotation. That's what I'm going to show explicitly. Okay? So it's merely for convenience as a first. So I will be interested now in computing expectation values for field operators. So I'm interested in computing expectation value of these 2 points, as this is defined simply as the expectation value of this product of fields weighted by this factor in the functional integral. So I have to compute the average of phi of x1, phi of x2 with the weight. And I normalize, of course, it's an expectation value by the partition function of the field. Okay? And now I have to be a little bit more specific about over which kind of configuration of field do I integrate. So I will be considering, in fact, as a space, not infinite space as first, but I consider a box of size L by L by et cetera with periodic boundary conditions. So it's in fact a torus. For convenience also. And at the end, I will go back to infinite space by taking the limit L goes to infinity. Okay. So both space in that time, both space and time are periodic. Okay. And therefore, I have my big space. And which is in fact some kind of box with periodic boundary condition. And I have a point x1, I have a point x2 in my Euclidean space. And I want to compute what are the correlation between the fluctuation of this field variables when integrates over in the functional integral. Okay? And it's very easy to do the calculation using the functional integral formalism, but because we are, it's nothing but a Gaussian integral, over Gaussian variables, which are a vector in an infinite dimensional space. Okay? So we can just apply boldly the results that you know about how do you measure, how do you compute the correlation between Gaussian independent random variables. And in order to do that, let us rewrite the action simply as by doing a partial integration. It's easy that because we have periodic boundary condition, we can rewrite the Euclidean action as dd, the integral over space, and one half of phi minus the Laplace operator plus m squared times phi, where, of course, the Laplace operator is just the sum over mu of d mu. It's a Laplace operator. Okay? So you see that when you write the Euclidean action in that way, you see that it's just a quadratic form. Acting on the field. So you can write this in some sense as formally as, so you consider that the phi of x just makes a big vector phi. Then you have a big vector phi, and then you have a quadratic form, which is a matrix element of minus some operator. So you can write this in that way if you assume that phi is just a vector whose component all the points of space. Okay? Yes?
By the topology of torus?
So I consider that it's a topology of a torus.
What?
It's just a choice to which make calculations simpler. And at the end, we'll take the limit when the size of the torus is infinite. So we send the boundary of the space to infinity where the points are at finite distance. So in fact, we expect, and the calculation shows that it's not important. You see, so it's just here for convenience. There are some physical problems where the boundary condition and whether space is taken to be periodic or non-periodic are important. But for my calculation, it will not be important because I'm considering only at the end the limit when the space is infinite. You see. Okay, so you know that, and of course there is a factor h, so it's a quadratic form. So basically, what you have to compute is the expectation value of products of two random variables, which are distributed according to a normal distribution, so a Gaussian distribution with some weight factor. And you have seen that if you have a vector like that, if you have instead of having phi of x, you have a vector composed of, let us say, psi of a, with a equal 1 to n, so you have a finite number of random variables. Okay? And that the probability for one vector is proportional to exponential of minus one half of the quadratic form psi a k a b psi b, where I am summing over the repeated indices. So this is okay. Then you know that the expectation value of a product of two vectors of 2 quantum psi A, psi B is just given by the matrix element AB of the inverse of the matrix K. So this is just the inverse of K. You see? So from that, we expect that phi of x, phi of y, phi of x1, phi of x2, I'm sorry, it's x1, x2, no need to introduce an y. We expect that this will be given simply by the inverse of the operator minus the Laplace operator plus m squared and divided by h bar, because there is an h bar here. So we take the inverse of this operator, and we take, in fact, the matrix element between the point x1 and x2. Okay. So we have to consider the inverse of a differential operator. Okay. So what does it mean? let me call this function a function. So, of course, this is inverse of something which is proportional to 1 over h bar. So there will be a h bar here times a function which I'll call g naught of x1 and x2, which is the inverse of this operator. And what does this mean? That you have a function which is the inverse of a differential operator. Well, you just have to think of what's happening when you are considering matrices. When you are considering matrices, the inverse of k minus 1 is defined simply by the fact that if you multiply the operator k minus 1 by the operator k, you get the operator identity, which means that if you have k a b k minus 1 b c and you sum over the c, you get the matrix element of the identity operator AC, so this is a Kronecker delta indices, the delta indices between A and C. Okay? So here, what does it mean? Here, the operator we are considering is, instead of K, we are considering this operator. So the operator K is minus the Laplace operator plus M squared. So this product means that we apply the Laplace operator plus M squared to the function g of x1, x2, okay? But remember, x1 and x2 play the role of the vector indices a and b. So when we multiply k, this means we are applying this operator here to the index b of this operator. So it means that here I am taking the Laplace operator with respect to the first position, because the first position in space is represents the first index of the matrix of this function viewed as a matrix element. So I have to apply the Laplace operator plus m squared with respect to the position x1 of this function, which depends both on x1 and x2. And what do I get on the right-hand side? I get the analog of the delta of the identity matrix for this operator. And the analog of the identity matrix is just the Dirac delta function in D dimension between the 2 points. Because you see, this is 1 if the 2 indices are the same, and this is 0 if the 2 indices are not the same. So the analog here in the continuum space is the delta function, which vanishes except if x1 equals x2. Okay? So this is the equation which must be satisfied by this function g naught. Yes?
So the operator Laplace, it should have 2 indices, right? 2 arguments.
The operator?
The operator which acts on G
Yes.
That should have like two arguments, right?
Yeah, so in fact it has two arguments exactly the same thing. So if you want to be a little bit more precise, in fact, this object is called the internal kernel of an operator. So I don't know if you have seen operator acting on function and integral kernels in your math lecture. Do you? No? Nothing. Okay. So then I will explain that a little bit. You see, this is to consider that you have two operators. So one word on operators and integral kernels. Assume that you have an operator A, an operator A, acting on functions psi of x. Okay. So it means that the operator means that if you apply the operator to a function psi of x, you get another function, let's just call it, which is a function a psi of x. So if this operator is a linear operator, it means that you can express this function in terms of all the value of psi to any other point of space. So you are supposed to integrate this over dy. And then you have the analogous matrix element, which is a function of x and y. Okay. So this is an operator acting on a function. Is associated a function of two positions, which is called the integral of A. Okay? So now, what does it mean to have, if you have two operators A and B, what is the integral kernel of the operator A times B? It's easy to see that if you, so A has an integral kernel A of xy, B as an integral kernel y, b of y and z. And the integral kernel of AB is simply dz, a of x, of, I'm sorry, I will put it here, z, x, a of xy, and b of y, z. So this is the definition of what is a multiplication of operator acting on function in terms of the internal kernel, OK? So then, you may ask, what is the operator, what is the integral kernel of the operator minus the Laplace operator plus m squared? Okay. So we know the result. The result is that A minus Laplace operator plus m squared applied to a function psi of x. This is simply minus Laplacian with respect to x of plus m squared of psi of x.
Okay. The integral be over y.
Pardon?
Should the integral be over y? Over
here's the integral. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. The integral, of course, is on the intermediate factor, which is y. So right. The integral, of course, is.
How come it's called the kernel?
Yes.
Why is it called a kernel? Like a kernel is the space that sets the
object. You have several mathematical objects which are called kernel in mathematics.
Okay.
So one is just the subspace of vector space of the vector which gives zero when you apply some integral kernel. And that's a different kernel.
Okay.
It's a kernel which is something which is inside an integral. So you see, you have some kind of fruit, and here is a kernel of the fruit. There are also other definitions. If you type kernel and math in Wikipedia, we'll have lists of different definitions.
Okay.
So it has nothing to do with the kernel of an operator acting on a linear space. So, okay. This operator also has a kernel considered as, but it's something different. So it's an integral kernel, which has nothing to do with the kernel. Okay. So let me go back to this. Of course, you can rewrite this as, if you want to rewrite this under this form, what you have to do is simply to rewrite psi of x as integral dy delta of x minus y psi of y. You have done nothing. Okay? But then this, you can write this as minus Laplacian with respect to x of delta of x minus y times psi of y, and you can integrate over dy. So in fact, this is the integral kernel of the operator minus Laplace operator plus m squared. So you see that, in fact, this amounts to this definition. And you see that in particular that the integral kernel of a differential operator is, in fact, is not really a function because it involves a distribution. So it's a derivative. It involves derivative of a distribution. So in fact, integral kernels is a distribution, not a function. But it's not a problem. Okay? Okay, so let me go back to this solution. So we have to solve this equation. We have to solve this this equation to find what is this object and so therefore what is this vacuum expectation this expectation value of products of operator. So this equation I wrote, well, let me put it, play a little bit more. Oh, no. Okay. Okay, well, so this equation I wrote before is an elliptic differential equation. In fact, it's an elliptic partial differential equation. And the best way to solve this equation is simply to go to Fourier transform. Because if so, we can make first remark. First, because of the fact that in fact the action is invariant under translation, we expect that g naught of x1 and x2 will be in fact simply a function of the difference of the vector between the two points. Okay, so that's because of translation invariance. Can prove that in fact it has this property, but you see from translation invariance of the action and of the equation, it will be only a function of those two points. So in fact, we have to solve the equation minus Laplacian plus m squared of g naught of x equal delta d of x. Okay? So now let us define the Fourier transform of g naught, g hat of k, as usual, as d dx exponential minus I k vector x. Remember, k and x are vectors, times g naught of x. Okay? And if we do Fourier transform, then this equation becomes the square of the vector k plus m squared times g hat of k equal the Fourier transform of the Dirac distribution, and the Fourier transform of the Dirac distribution is 1. Okay? Because, you know, the Fourier transform of the operator minus Laplacian is k squared, simply because the Fourier transform of d over dx mu is I minus I k mu. And when you take the square of that, you get the square of k, where, of course, k squared is, and therefore, delta equals minus squared, where this is minus sum over mu of k mu k mu. Okay, remember we are always in Euclidean space. Okay, and therefore we know that g naught of k is 1 over k squared plus m squared. So it's a Lorentz distribution. And as a consequence, we know that g naught of x will be given by the inverse Fourier transform of 1 over k squared plus m squared. So the inverse Fourier transform is given by this, where this is I, this is the vector product between the vector k and the vector x. And remember, k is a vector, so k is a vector with d component k mu. Okay? Okay, so now what are the properties of this object? First, you can show quite easily that we are interested in two. First, you can, in fact, you can compute this equation. In fact, you can either compute this integral or solve this equation. For instance, going to radial coordinates, because in fact it's a function of the modulus of k. It's also invariant by rotation. And you find at the m that there is an explicit formula for this function, which is 2 pi over the mass parameter, the modulus of the vector is to the power 2 minus d over 2 times some special function, which is a modified Bessel function of x, the modulus of vector x times the mass parameter of the field. Okay, so this is a special function which is called a modified Bessel function of the second kind, if you like, special functions. Okay. So what are the properties of this function? And of course, in fact, one last word, warning, when I am looking at this solution, I took the limit L goes to infinity, so that space is the Euclidean plane, d-dimensional Euclidean plane already, because this is, I'm using a continuous Fourier transform. I am integrating over the whole space. And I have used, in fact, the fact that when solving this equation, this is the only solution which decays at infinity. Okay. So let us look at this function. This function first has two properties. First, I can be interested in what's happening when at large distances. At large distances, it's quite easy to show by various methods that this function g naught of x behaves as exponential of minus the modulus of the vector x times the mass parameter. So there is an exponential decay. At large distances. Okay? And in fact, this function, which has this behavior, is the only solution of this equation which has exponential decay at large distances. You can add a solution of this equation without the second, the right hand side, but the solution always grows in some direction. So this is the only solution which has an exponential decay at large distances, and therefore the only solution which is consistent with the fact that you are quantizing your field in a box and then taking the limit of the box, the size of the box, to infinity. Okay? So that's the first point. And in some sense, you see that you have an exponential decay with a proportional m, so m is the mass parameter in the action is the analogous of a correlation length in the equivalent statistical mechanical problem. Okay. Now, we can also be interested in what's happening when, and then I will perhaps discuss that on the next blackboard. Yes?
Dimension independent?
Yes, this result is dimension independent.
Also in two dimensions?
Pardon?
It's also decays in two dimensions?
Yes, because we are looking at what's happening at large distances. Okay, so this is a result which is independent on, it's independent on what's happening on the dimension. You have prefactors which depend on the dimension, but the leading exponential term is independent of the dimension. Well, that's not what I wanted to have. So this is front, so I want to have front here. Sorry. Okay. So now, something important is to look at what's happening when x goes to 0, small distance behavior. And that's important because we have seen on the picture I saw last lecture that the typical configuration of the field in which are important in the functional integral are very wild field configuration at short distances. There was some average at large distances, which means that indeed the fluctuations are not very large, the correlation. That's what we recover. But at short distance, it's very wild. And you can show very easily that this function g naught of x behaves this fact as the modulus of the vector with the power 2 minus d if the dimension is larger than 2. And there is some coefficient in front of that that I won't write it here, but there is some constant depending on the dimension. And if the dimension is 2, you may say, well, that's very well. When the dimension is 2, this is a power 0, so it behaves regularly. But that's not true because it's also it can be consistent with the logarithm. So it behaves, in fact, as logarithm of x with negative fact. So that is divergent. And some factor, which I think is 1 over 2 pi or something like that. OK. So. You see that there is a singularity at short distances. Okay? And this means that indeed the behavior of the field in the functional integral is very singular at short distances because remember, what is phi squared of x? If you are interested into the expectation value of the product of the field, of the square of the field at a given point, this is simply from what we have seen before, h bar g naught of x, and therefore this is infinite, as long as the dimension of space-time is larger or equal to 2. So in one dimension, of course, there is no problem. The square of the position of a particle in quantum mechanics is a well-defined operator, but this object is not well defined. So you have what are called short distance singularity or ultraviolet divergences. Okay. And why ultraviolet? It's called ultraviolet simply because g naught x can be written of 0 can be written in Fourier transform d dk over 2 pi over d. When x equals 0, you don't have the oscillating factor which makes the integral convergent, and you have just 1 over k squared plus m squared, and you have a divergence for large momenta or energy, if you prefer. Okay. We are in Euclidean space, but you can still think of momenta as energies. So this is related to the high energy behavior or the high momenta behavior of this integral. Therefore, it's called ultraviolet. Okay. Okay. So up to now, so those are the very important properties you need to know about the large distance behavior and the short distance behavior of the propagator. Okay. Now, of course, I worked. Everything that I've been doing is in Euclidean space up to now. And we are interested, in fact, in a quantum theory. So we are interested in what is happening in Minkowski space. So remember now that we have seen in quantum mechanics that if we start from a vector which is of the form tau x in Euclidean space, and if we go to x equal I tau it, so this is an Euclidean vector. If we make a weak rotation by making the first coordinate in space, in Euclidean space, which corresponds to imaginary time, if we make it imaginary, then we recover what is happening in real space. So this is a vector in Minkowski space, and this is the corresponding vector in Euclidean space. So this is called the weak rotation, and this corresponds to make the transformation. If here I am, for instance, think that here I am, this represent tau. This is Euclidean, Euclidean time. And I have to do this transformation to recover real time. So I consider this component as a complex parameter. This is the real part of Euclidean time. This is the imaginary part of Euclidean time. And by making this weak rotation in all the quantities that I'm computing, I'm recovering what's happening here at real time t by the relation tau equal I t. Okay? So I start from a real Euclidean time. I make a weak rotation by an angle plus pi over 2, and I recover what's happening for the theory at real time. And in particular, we have seen that by this operation, we expect, if the formalism is consistent, that going from an expectation value of the products of two fields at two different points, x1 and x2 in Euclidean space, by performing the weak rotation, we should recover, if everything is consistent, the vacuum expectation value of the time order product of the two fields at the two points x1 and x2. So remember, those are points in Euclidean space, and those are the corresponding points in Minkowski space-time. So this is in Minkowski space-time. So let us check whether this works from our results. Okay? So one has just to be a little bit careful here. Remember, so I start to compute, I have g naught of x, which is the integral, and remember, here x will be an Euclidean spacetime, so x is here tau vector, and therefore, when I integrate over k in d dimension, the vector k has one component, which let me call it k naught, and a space component, which is k. Okay, and if I am careful, this is d of k naught, d minus 1 of k. So I first integrate over this component and then on the other component. And I have an exponential of I, and here I have k naught tau plus k times x, e to the I, divided by k naught squared plus k squared plus m squared. Okay? And now I want to perform this rotation for the first component of tau. But you see, if I'm rotating tau and I give tau an imaginary part, then I have an exponential which is not oscillating, but which is growing in one direction and decaying in the other direction. So this is you have to think about what you are doing in case in the k naught plane. So this is the k naught complex plane. And at the beginning, I'm integrating over this contour of integration, you see. So this, I am integrating here under such a contour which goes to minus infinity to plus infinity. Okay? And if I am rotating tau, in order to keep a phase here, which is still just a phase, I have to rotate by an anti-Vic rotation the contour of integration of k naught so that it becomes a contour like that. You see? And so this is, if you want, the Euclidean integration contour. And if I am going from a real tau to an imaginary tau, then this is the Minkowskian integration contour that I must choose. And if I am doing that, it means that, in fact, I change t equal I, tau equal I t, where t is real time. But in the same time, I must change k naught into minus I times a real time component of the momenta that I call the frequency or pulsation. So this is real time. And this is a real, if you want, energy component of a vector. Okay. And then you have to be a little careful because you have to check what does this integral becomes when you make this Vic rotation. You get a minus. You get a d omega. D minus one of k. Over two pi at the power d. You get a factor minus I coming from the integral, because you still integrate from minus infinity to plus infinity. Okay? Then you get an exponential I, and then you still have omega t plus kx. You still have a phase. And here you have minus omega squared plus k squared plus omega squared, you see? And here, you have a potential problem because this integral, when you integrate from minus infinity to plus infinity, you have potential poles, you have poles, singularity, at omega equal plus or minus square root of k squared plus m squared, which is, of course, the relation between the energy and the impulsion of a particle of mass m in relativistic. Okay. And we have to know how to deal with these poles. But remember, these poles are just the poles of this original quantity at k naught equal plus or minus I square root of k squared plus m squared. So those poles are just two poles which sits there. I'm sorry, not in momentum, in momentum space. I have a pole here. I have a pole here. You see? And this perception of by the Vick rotation, you know that you have to choose it that way. So you are going to the right of the pole on the lower half plane and to the left of the pole on the upper half plane. So now just redraw this picture, not in terms of k naught, but in terms of omega. So in terms of omega, what does this give? This is omega. This is the real part of omega. This is the imaginary part of omega. I'm just taking this picture and turn it that way. Then the poles are here and here. But I know that the contour of integration is going. So these poles, I turn this picture. No, I'm sorry. I'm going that way. So I turn this picture that way. I am integrating over omega like that. You see, that's because I'm taking minus I omega. And therefore, here, you see that I'm going slightly below the pole, and I'm going slightly above the pole like that. Okay? And this means that, in fact, in this contour of integration, this is equivalent to take the Feynman integration prescription contour, which gives you the Feynman propagator instead of an advanced or the retard propagator. Yes?
It's a rotational point. The x in the exponential. The x and the k, one is a contravariant, one is covariant.
Yeah, in fact, you have to think that, in fact, of course, indeed, the component of x are the x mu, and the component of the k are the k u, which explains that why you have always a plus sign here and a plus sign here. So this one is, I never remember which one, contravariant. Contravariant, this is covariant. Okay? And you have a minus I here. Here you have a minus omega squared plus k squared plus m squared. And if you go back, for instance, to the book of Peskin, you have, in fact, a factor I here and omega squared minus k squared plus m squared. So everything is consistent. Okay? So we indeed recover. In fact, by an explicit calculation, we have recovered here that this is the propagator of Feynman corresponding to the vacuum expectation value of the time ordered product of those operators. Okay. So everything is consistent. Okay. So perhaps before I go to higher correlation function and to the Vick theorem, one little break. I will show you just some pictures that you probably have seen in some books of those propagators. Yes. Okay, so I presume you have already seen those. I don't know if you have seen that in a picture, but if you compute, you start from the expression and you ask some software to draw the picture. So this is the picture in real space of the propagator for the massive theory in two dimension. I'm simply considering that in two dimension. So this is the Euclidean propagator in the propagator in Euclidean space. So time and space are just two different components of the same space. And you see that this here it has a logarithmic singularity. It has a peak and it decays at infinity exponentially, and it is rotationally invariant. And when you go to, you take this picture and you make its analytic continuation to imaginary time, you recover indeed the Feynman propagator, which now is, it is complex in general. It has a real part and an imaginary part. And what you check is that this is the real part of the Feynman propagator. And it has, you see, this is the future, this is time, this is space. So this is the future cone, this is the past cone, and this is the space-like region. And the propagator, in fact, has this, the divergence at k equals zero becomes a causal singularity along the light cone. So you see the light cone. You see that in the future and the past region, you have oscillation which correspond to the propagation of the particle. And basically, this is the correlation length of the model. Those oscillations correspond to the mass of the particle. And it's decays very quickly in the space region because here the space region is equivalent to what's going on here, time equals zero. Now the imaginary part you can check. In fact, it is zero, exactly zero in the space-like region because the propagator is causal, so you cannot have propagation of information in the space-like region. But it has a singularity with propagation in the past cone and in the future cone and in the past cone because it's a Feynman propagator, not the retarded propagator where it would be non-zero only here, neither the advanced propagator where it would be only here. You see? Okay. Pardon?
The real part is not strictly zero?
Is it?
Is it not zero?
No, no, it's not zero here because you see, if you take if you make the time to be zero in the space-like region, space coincides with what's happening with space in the Euclidean regime. Because if time is zero, the metric is the same.
No, but outside the light cone.
Here?
Yeah.
No, no, it's non-zero. Because it's here the value is of the real part of the Feynman propagator in the space-like region is the same than the value of the Feynman propagator in the Euclidean regime. So it's non-zero. It's decaying very quickly, but it's non-zero. Yes?
So why is the imaginary part corresponding to the propagation of information?
Pardon?
Why does the imaginary part correspond to causal propagation of information?
I think you have to work a little bit more. If you compute really what's going on and you try to measure the correlation and in which channel is the energy and information really transported, you see that it will correspond to the imaginary part. Particularly, if you take, for instance, the retarded propagator, then the retarded propagator is zero everywhere here. So it's a causal propagator corresponding. You prepare your state and you let it evolve. Then it's zero everywhere, but here is a future cone. So everything is consistent. But I don't think I have time to discuss that. Okay. Okay, so can you... switch off the main. So now, one last word about the endpoint correlation functions. Okay? It's very easy to compute now in the Euclidean regime the analog of the correlation function of two fields. Now you take products of n fields in the Euclidean region at the different points. So you have different points in space-time, xn. And this should correspond by a Vick rotation to the time-ordered product, the vacuum expectation value of the time-ordered product of all those operators. So it means that, in fact, you are taking the products where you have first the phi of the first point in the time direction, then the second one, then the third one, etc. And this is analogous to if you are using the results of Gaussian integration, you know that in general, if you have a Gaussian random variables with mean value, so psi A equals 0, then you know that if you construct you are interested in the expectation value of n different values. This is given by the sum over pairings by 2 of psi of the products of all the possible pairings. Okay? And this theorem is called the Vick theorem in physics. And you have already met him, showed it in the concept of canonical quantization for the quantization of the free field. Here, this is just a result on the correlation function, so the expectation value of Gaussian random variables with mean value equal to 0 for any kind of Gaussian variables. And therefore, this means, in our case, this means that this object will be given exactly by the same kind of pairing. So for instance, if you consider the products of field at 4 different points, it will be given by the 4 different pairing. So let me draw those 4 points, x1, x2, x3, x4. You have a pairing where you can pair x1 with x2 and x3 with x4. You can pair x1 with x4 and x2 with x3. And you can pair x1 with x3 and x2 with x4. So what you get finally is the corresponding term, which are phi of x1, phi of x2 times phi of x3 times phi of x4 plus the term corresponding to the yellow contraction, which is, phi of x1, phi of x3 times phi of x2, phi of x4 plus the remaining one, which is phi of x1, phi of x4 times phi of x2, phi of x3, which is a result that you have seen already, or I think obtained using the canonical formalism. And it's a result which is valid both for the Euclidean field theory and for the field theory in real time, because it's basically a result of probability on Gaussian variables. Okay? And of course, you can represent this in terms of Feynman diagrams as you did already in Feynman. So you can represent phi of x, phi of y by just a line joining the point x1 and x2. And the value of this is, as remember, this is h bar times the function x1 minus x2. And in that case, it means that you represent the four-point correlation function. So I represent the correlation function just by some big box with the 3 points here, the point 1, 2, 3, and 4. So such a correlation function represents this big object, and this is given by the Feynman rule by these diagrams. 1, 2, 3, 4 plus these diagrams. 1, 2, 3, 4 plus these diagrams. 1, 4, 2, and 3. Okay. Okay. So I won't elaborate further because you have, I think, already seen that and manipulated that in the quantum theory one course. Okay? And of course, you can generalize that for generalize to any n. Of course, n has to be odd. If it's has to be even. The expectation value of an odd number of points is zero, because you cannot pair an odd number of points. But that's also just a reflection of the fact that the action, the original action, is invariant under. So if n is 2m plus 1, you get 0. You get 0 simply because the action is invariant under a change by a sign of phi of x. So this reflects just the symmetry of the original theory if you change the sign of the field. So this reflects a symmetry, a trivial symmetry, but a symmetry of the action as a phi of the quantum theory. See? Okay. So I have still a quarter of an hour. So I think I will skip at that stage discussion about the singularities, the short distance or ultraviolet divergence, because much more can be said about the ultraviolet divergences of the theory, where when you are considering in an endpoint correlation function what's happening when 2 points or 3 points or n points come close together. There is a very interesting structure which is very important for quantum field theory, but I think I will discuss it later. But remember that, in fact, in this kind of trivial system for trivial quantities that you know how to compute exactly for the free field theory, there is a lot of structure hidden. But I will just start now to discuss, of course, the next step, which is to deal with a non-trivial quantum theory with interaction. So let us go back to, this is the way. Yes, so let us now try to construct the interacting theory. So I can erase that. Now, instead of considering the free field, I'm considering a field with interactions. Okay? And I will consider the theory, which is the simplest one, which is called the phi-4 theory, which is very important. First, it's the simplest example of an interacting quantum theory, and a lot can be learned by studying it. Second, it's important in physics because it corresponds, in fact, remember, the phi corresponds, the phi is a field, and its quanta are particles of mass m. You have seen that. It's clear in the canonical formalism, quantization formalism. But since we recover the same Feynman propagator, you can derive the fact that there are particles in your theory from the form of the propagator you have derived from the quantization of the field. In fact, this field contains quanta, which are particles. Okay, so the quanta are particles of mass m. Are the quanta of the phi field. So the phi operator contains the creation and annihilation of phi, and therefore a phi 4 interaction term corresponds to a contact local interaction between two particles. And this will become clear later. So let me add to the free field term a term which will be plus G over factorial 4 of phi 4. So I have a local term, which is non-quadratic, phi 4. So I have a coupling constant, so I have an interaction, a phi 4 interaction. G is positive, and it's called the coupling constant. Okay? And the normalization by a factor 1 over factorial of 4, 1 over 24, is just here for convenience. Of course, it's just a normalization of the field, but it's very convenient to use that because a lot of counting factors when you apply the Fick theorem simplifies. Okay. And then, formally, I am interested in computing now the same kind of quantity like the propagator and the endpoint function using this interacting theory. So, naively, we can say, okay, just let us just apply the rule of functional integration in the same way that you have started to quantize such theories by applying the rules of canonical quantization. So the idea is just to replace the free field action by this non-trivial action in the functional integral and try to compute, okay? So of course, it's quite difficult. So in general, because it's a very complicated integral, and for the mathematician, it's much more difficult to study such integrals than the integral of the free field, which are Gaussian variables. And therefore, of course, what has been done from the beginning and which is still done in a lot of cases is to do perturbation theory. Pardon? It's obvious because, remember, this. Why is G positive? Because this is a potential. So this term is positive in the Euclidean regime. Okay, this term is positive if G is positive because then the potential, remember, if G is positive and M squared is positive, the potential V of phi, this, we can regroup this into a potential V of phi, and this potential is of this form. So it's bounded from below. So you have an exponential of something minus something which is bounded from below. So the integral is well defined. This is still well defined if m squared is negative, because then, but g positive, because the potential will be like that. So it's still bounded from below, but simply the ground state is non-trivial. But and that's very interesting in physics, because in particular, that's the kind of potential you meet in the X model standard interaction. But if G is negative and M squared is positive, the potential, of course, for small phi is still positive. But for large phi, it's unbounded from below, which means two things. First, this integral is not convergent. So you have mathematical problem in defining the functional integral. But it means also that the naive vacuum of the theory. Imagine that you set G, if G is very, very small, you see, this occurs very, very far away. So if G is very small, you have a potential which is an harmonic potential for a very long time, and then simply you grow like that. So you don't feel You think you don't feel the fact that the potential is unbounded from below. See? But remember, this is the classical action for a classical theory that we are going to quantize. And if you view the field as some position variable for the quantum theory, you are starting from there. You have a big wall, and then it goes down. And in quantum theory, you can always have quantum tunneling through this barrier, however high it is. So in fact, if G is negative, the vacuum is unstable because of tunneling. And the theory is ill-defined. Okay, the theory is ill-defined because there is no ground state you can start from to quantize the theory.
Well, there might be other things.
Pardon?
Oh, no, I was wondering if there might be some higher terms like phi 6 or that.
Yeah, you may had higher terms, of course. You may said, okay, let us assume that there is a phi 6 term very long. But that's a different theory. And I want to consider the simplest theory with only two body interactions. Okay. As we shall see, in fact, you see also that this term is positive, is G is positive. And if you assume that phi 4 corresponds to a two body interaction, imagine you have one particle, it propagates. You have another particle, it propagates, and they have an interaction if they are in contact at the same point, you see? And if G is positive, it means that it costs energy. This is the energy part. So the interaction is repulsive. Okay? If G is negative, the interaction is attractive. Okay? So if they come together, they tend to glue together. If there were non-relativistic particles, this won't be much of a problem. But remember, first, the quanta of the particles are bosons. And we are in a relativistic setup. So you can create particles. The fluctuation of the vacuum creates a pair of particles. Okay, and if the attraction is positive, if it's attractive, two particles can come closer, stay glued. Then you have vacuum fluctuation, which creates more particles here, which stay together. And you create an infinite number of particles without, you can't stop that process. And this process of creation and condensation of bosons, of relativistic bosons, in fact, is another way to describe the fact that you are creating particles with some probability through tunneling effect and then going to a place where the number of particles is infinite at any point of space. So you have different way to view the fact that the theory makes sense only if the coupling constant is positive. Okay? So let me go back and just explain the principle of perturbation theory, and we'll discuss in fact its structure and what you can do with that and what are the problems with perturbation theory in the next lecture. So this is middle, so I want to have middle here. And what does it mean to do perturbation theory? It means that we assume that G is small, the coupling constant, we assume G is small, and then we expand the exponential. So remember, in the functional integral, we have a term which is exponential of minus 1 over h bar integral d dx g over factorial 4 phi 4 of x, which is a part of this exponential. And we can, of course, expand the exponential as a sum from k equals 0 to infinity of minus g over factorial of 4 h4 to the power k, 1 over factorial k. And then we have to the power k of this integral that you can write as integral over dx1 up to dxk in d dimension of phi 4 of x1, phi 4 of xk. You see? So, first step is to expand the exponential. And the second term when doing perturbation theory is to invert the functional integrals times the sum over k, which is there, into sum over k and the functional integral. And this inversion is, in fact, warning. This is a highly non-trivial process. There are a lot of mathematical subtleties associated to this inversion. And we'll see those problems popping out when we compute this naively and when assuming that we can invert those two series. And if you are going those two series, of course, you see that basically, what you have to compute, in order to compute phi of x1, phi of xy, you have to compute, in fact, the numerator, the denominator, you have to expand them in G. So let us just consider the numerator here, the numerator of this quantity. The numerator in phi of x1, xy contains, you have to compute, in particular, you see, function which will be that I will denote by z of z. So I am interested in computing phi of z1, phi of zn in the theory with g different from 0. Z1 and z1 are just points like x1 and xn. Okay? But I use z for the position of the operator I'm interested in, and x for the operator in the perturbative expansion. And when I'm computing that, I have to compute at some point integral over d of phi, exponential minus 1 over h, s of phi, the free part when g equals 0, because I'm expanding only the interaction part. And then I have to compute things like sum over k, minus g over h bar factorial 4 to the power k times 1 over k, and this quantity, phi of z1, phi of zm1, and then the integral d4x1, ddx1, dd of xk, phi 4 of x1, phi 4 of xk, you see. The numerator can be expanded like that. And therefore, you can, of course, now, if I invert the sum of the integration, I have to compute with this weight this product of operator. So this can be rewritten as simply the expectation value of this product of operator. So this can be rewritten as sum over k of minus g over factorial 4 h bar to the power k, 1 over factorial k times the integral over the point associated to the phi 4, and then the expectation value of the product of the n external fields times the k and I compute the expectation value with respect to the g equals 0 theory. You see? So let me call this function z of z1 zn. Okay, so by definition, I call this big function given by a formal by a series in G, the function z of z1 zn. You see here you have n n that called s external phi, and here I have k internal phi to the 4. They are internal because you integrate over the position, while the position of the phi operator is fixed. Okay, and then, of course, you see that the quantity we are interested in at the beginning, the function phi of z1, phi of zn, in the theory with g different from 0, is just given by this z of z1, zn, divided by the factor, the same factor where you have no z. You have no external z, so I call this just z. Okay. So it's just a notation, and I can call this a function g of z1, zn. So the correlation function of n field in the interacting theory is just a ratio of two functions, which involves just expectation value in the free field theory of products of phi and phi 4, integrated over the position of the internal vertices. Okay? And finally, to compute this, so fine, we have to compute this integral of these products of field. And the and now, finally, the final trick is that you can use the Wick theorem. So if you cannot see that, this is front. So finally, and I will end up here. You can use Wick theorem which is explained here to compute this product, the expectation value of products of field, and then integrate over the x g's, g equal 1 to k. And if you are able to compute that, you should be able to compute this function at least as an as a series in the coupling constant. You see? And we can use Wick theorem because we are computing this in the theory g equals 0. So because we have to go to, this is an expectation value. This is a vacuum expectation value in the free theory that we have studied. Okay. And then I think it's a good time to stop. Anyway, I have to stop. So next time, we will discuss a little bit the structure of this object when you apply Wick theorem and expand it in terms of this kind of Feynman diagrams, but they will be more complicated. And you will meet the Feynman diagrams that you have already met in the quantum field theory one course, derived here in a different formalism, because we are using a functional integral formalism. But at the end, you will get the same kind of diagrams. But simply one important difference that we'll discuss here is that at that level, we shall get diagrams with internal loops. And you will see immediately what it means once I will have drawn the diagrams. And you will see all the problems which are encountered in this calculation because you have diagrams with internal loops and problems which are not present at the level of tree diagrams, so scattering amplitudes, for instance, at the leading order that you have studied in the quantum field theory one course. Okay, so thank you.